lecture with Professor Dan Flores. The book is Wild New World, the epic story of animals and people in America. The man's name is Sir William Drummond Stewart. He began a safari, a luxurious safari in the West, middle of the 19th century. And what results from it is a massacre of animals, not only in excess of what you need to eat, but really what it looks like is serial killing, a mass massacre that has no justification in human history. The reason I mention him is that he's not alone, but you go on to detail, and I'm not going to read how much he took. He becomes a model for the other adventurers who come in the latter part of the century when the railroad makes it available to reach Montana or to reach Colorado. Was there any chastising of Stewart when they read about him back east or when they read about him in Europe? Anybody say, why are you doing this?
I don't find any evidence that anyone confronted William Drummond Stewart or St. George Gore or any of the other usually noblemen from Ireland or Great Britain who regarded the American West, particularly the Great Plains part of the American West, which was our analog of the Serengeti or the Masai Mara, as this destination to shoot animals. I don't find that anyone other than an occasional cartoonist in a newspaper ever really castigates these people for doing this. It's the same thing they're doing in Africa, of course, during the same period of time. It's the beginning of what we call the safari. The safari is a Swahili word, so it's an African word that we don't start using really commonly until the 1850s. In writing about this particular experience in the West, I call on readers of the book to think of having watched out of Africa Robert Redford, the white hunter in Africa. And this, of course, is in a later period in the early 20th century. But that's, in effect, what these men were doing, except out of Africa doesn't show the vast destruction that these European hunters engaged in. And St. George Gore, for example, in addition to several tons of ammunition and 50 or 60 firearms, is going to take along a steel bathtub on his trip. He takes along Shakespeare so he can read to his assembled throng from Shakespeare at night. So it has all the veneer of civilization. But during the daytime, what these people are doing is basically shooting as many animals as they can find and often keeping an enumeration of how many. It's the sort of thing that most Americans of the time kind of look on as it's just the Europeans being strange and weird in the way they can be. But it's something that some Americans, in fact, attempt to emulate in a later period. It's a disturbing part of the Western story, to be sure.
Philip Sheridan, and one of the heroes of the Civil War, becomes the commander of the Missouri Division of the West in Chicago. This is the latter part, second half of the 19th century. And Sheridan is defamed in a false witness from a man named Cook that he vouchsafes the destruction of the buffalo in order to destroy the Native Americans who depend upon the buffalo. It's a lie. Importantly, however, Phil Sheridan does write his own government protesting the slaughter of the buffalo. And Professor, you emphasize here this was not available. It's been found in the National Archives. What is Sheridan's case, the real Sheridan?
The real Sheridan was actually something of a naturalist. He did guide some of these safari hunters who came to him asking for assistance, because he was a hunter himself. But Philip Sheridan ended his life attempting to protect the animals of Yellowstone National Park from being poached. And it's one of the real ironies of his story in American history that a buffalo hunter, a former buffalo hunter in the early 20th century, John Cook, writing a memoir about the days when he was a buffalo hunter, attempts to establish the buffalo hunters as agents of civilization and agents of a government conspiracy to wipe out the buffalo by inventing this false speech that Sheridan, Cook claims, made to the legislature in Texas in the 1870s, when Texas, again, a false claim, supposedly was considering a bill to stop the buffalo hunt. So we tended to think of Sheridan as the villain of the buffalo story. The real Sheridan was something else entirely, though.
There was also a destruction of the wolves going on at the same time. And I said we'd come back to this subplot in the professor's work. At no point does it become obvious to me that anybody was studying the wolves. Now, is this before there was that understanding of biology, Professor? Because if anybody had paid attention to the wolves, they would see that they were in balance with the herds, in balance with the elk and the deer, taking down the sick and the old. Did anybody observe that, or was that just not acceptable journal writing in the 19th century?
America was still, in the late 19th century, basing its sensibilities about the role of animals like wolves in the world on these folk traditions, quite unscientific, from the old world. And so no one was studying wolves really until well into the 20th century, until a couple of naturalist brothers, Adolf and Olaus Murie, are going to begin studying predators in the 1930s and 1940s. So in the 1870s, 1880s, the period you're referring to, when the market economy is wiping out buffalo, wolf poisoners are wiping out wolves everywhere they can get at them, sometimes at the request of livestock associations who pay bounties on wolves. No one has any sense, any inkling, really, of ecological connections. I mean, the science of ecology dates to the 1860s, but we don't have an ecological society in America until 1915. So we don't have active ecologists until well into the early 20th century. And that means that all in this period of the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, I mean, federal government, to its credit, had never actually passed any kind of law to protect any animal in American history, and won't do so until 1900. And so we let buffalo be destroyed. The country allows passenger pigeons, the most numerous bird on earth, to be destroyed by the market economy. We allow animals like pronghorn antelope, which had probably had numbers rivaling buffalo, to be reduced to only a few thousand animals by the end of the 1800s. And nobody really lifts a finger to stop this. We just regard this as part of the collateral damage of the advance of old world civilization across the Americas.
Theodore Roosevelt is celebrated as a conservationist and as a man who is important as president about the creation of national parks. But I learned from you that the Boone and Crockett Club was a hunter's paradise, not a conservationist. What was the Boone and Crockett Club at the time?
The Boone and Crockett Club was an organization of hunters, well-to-do Eastern elite hunters primarily, men who were close associates of Teddy Roosevelt, George Bird Grinnell, the conservationist editor of Forest and Stream magazine. And they represented a group that is very important in this story, because they do understand and recognize well that in order to preserve the animals that they want to keep hunting, that they want to shoot, we're going to have to take really sort of Hail Mary action. So out of the early Boone and Crockett Club meetings comes the idea that eventually will allow the United States to establish national forests, national parks, national grasslands, national monuments, this huge preservation of landscapes that really has no analog in Europe in the old world, and that eventually will allow us to establish some new strategy that's different from Europe in the way we interact with wild animals. But what Roosevelt is really interested in is having animals to hunt.
The book is Wild New World, the epic story of animals and people in America. Professor Dan Flores is the author. We turn away from the massacre of the animals to what can be done in the 20th and now 21st century. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.